Hello and welcome. You're listening to the podcast where being labeled a heretic is a good thing. We're starting conversations about God, politics, sexuality, spiritual formation, how we got here, and how to move forward post-evangelicalism. Nothing is off limits in our conversations with scholars, seekers, activists, and writers in our quest to uncover the heart of faith. Welcome to Holy Heretics.
Welcome to Holy Heretics, everybody. I'm your host, Gary Allen, and we are back with another episode. And today, if you are a regular listener, you're going to notice something different. We typically do an interview style kind of show, but I want to turn the mic around and talk about something that has been on my mind and heart lately, and I would love to know what your thoughts are on this as well. I was in the middle of interviewing faith deconstruction coach Angela Harrington a few weeks ago when something hit me that I don't really like some of the language that we use in the deconstruction community. I don't like some of the premise that our movement has been founded on. For instance, we use words like deconstruct, dismantle, tear down, rebuild, reconstruct, and all of this hints at a problem within our movement. In many ways, we are merely replacing one set of harmful beliefs with another more progressive set of beliefs. And I started a conversation on Facebook about this the other day, and it really blew up. It resonated with people. And so I wanted to kind of dive into it a little bit deeper here, because I don't think that the simple trading of ideas that we see as deconstruction and reconstruction is really the end goal of what we're about. It's a great place to start, but it doesn't really go far enough because this mindset is stuck in the mind. It assumes Christianity is a religion of right beliefs. And if I just get rid of the bad beliefs and replace them with better beliefs, then I've deconstructed and reconstructed. But Christianity in its most primitive and purest form isn't really about those things at all. It's not about believing the right thing. It is about a way of life that is rooted in divine intimacy with our Creator. And I think this requires a holistic approach to spirituality that transcends the rational, the intellect, and mere beliefs. So what we require if we are truly going to recover from evangelicalism, and not only just deconstruct and reconstruct, I think we need nothing less than an embodied, creation-centered, indigenous, holistic approach to spirituality. It's the holistic transformation of the self into a contemplative way of being and seeing and believing that is what we are really after, in my opinion. Otherwise, we just remain dualistic. We're just stuck in this us versus them combative nature toward our former faith to where, hey, look, we have the right beliefs, you have the wrong beliefs. And this is all incredibly dualistic and ego-driven. So until the ex-evangelical community recognizes the need not only to dismantle harmful theology, but to mature into the contemplative mind and heart, my fear is that we've only just begun the journey. In the 1960s, Jesuit Father Karl Rahner stated that Christians in the future would either be mystics or they would not be Christian at all. And I like how Richard Rohr has talked about this in terms of this move from the rational and the pragmatic and the practical to the spiritual or the mystical. He says, without a contemplative mind, we are offering the world no broad seeing, no real alternative consciousness, no new kind of people, no healing of past hurts. Otherwise, we are simply putting new wine into old wineskins. And that's why I really want to talk about this whole notion that I think instead of merely reconstructing Christianity, we have an opportunity to rewild Christianity. And what might that rewilding process even look like? I think for far too long, Christianity has been captivated by white European rationalistic theology, and it's what Brian McLaren means when he wrote, most theology in recent centuries, especially white Christian theology, has been the work of avid indoorsmen, Scholars who typically work in square boxes called offices or classrooms or sanctuaries, surrounded by square books and more recently square screens under square roofs in square buildings. There is nothing inherently wrong about civilized indoor theology except this. Theology that arises in human-made, human-controlled architecture of walls and mirrors, of doors and locks, will surely reflect the prejudices and limitations of its makers. And what I think he's pointing to is that so much of Christianity is left-brained. It is about words and books and text and interpretation of text and getting the right answers and systems and theologies. And all of those give answers, but they don't ask a lot of questions. So for me, 4 years into my deconstruction journey, I'm trying to imagine a more radical approach than mere reconstruction. Instead of rebuilding, sounds kind of funny, but I'd rather rewild or at least return to an ancient form of Christianity that is centered in creation-centered spirituality, one that recognizes God's manifest reality in all things. I am looking for a spirituality that is intimately connected to the natural world, and I long for a wild spirituality untethered from libraries and blog posts and, hell, even podcasts. I don't want to be domesticated by systemic theology or systematic theology in conference speakers. I would rather take my cue from nature, from the eagle, from mountains, from rivers, from the ever-changing cycles of the season. Because prior to the written word, the created world was God's prime revelation. It was the source of all wisdom. As Thomas Berry wrote, God's first revelation wasn't the Bible, it was creation. And I do wonder if this sort of sense of rewilding is what first drove John the Baptist out into the wilderness to proclaim God's coming kingdom, or why Jesus spent so much of his time outdoors speaking and teaching, why he pointed us not just to a text, but to the lilies of the field, the birds of the air, the grass in the fields. And I also find it interesting that the only times Jesus ever got in big trouble was when he went into the city, when he went into man-made temple structures. Contrary to our church buildings and cathedrals, even to our rich liturgical heritage and worship sets, there is an inherent freedom to the natural world. It isn't contrived, and frankly, it can't be controlled. It is a place of wild abundance of mystery and reciprocal connection with the divine. No wonder the hills and groves were God's first temples, and why God wasn't really fond of the fact that the Israelites made her a home. Or as the Tao Te Ching said, the world is a sacred vessel. But in our modern world and in our Western civilized minds, we have often become divorced from the world as a sacred vessel. We've frankly become divorced from the world, her wisdom, and we've been domesticated by the dullness that is the rational, the pragmatic, and the practical. We have lost any experience with the beautiful, with the true, with the mysterious, with wonder. The great environmentalist John Muir proclaimed, "Everybody needs beauty as well as bread, places to play in and pray in, where nature may heal and give strength to body and soul alike." So if this is my quest, I would love for it to be your quest as well. How do we rewild faith and not merely reconstruct it? Well, I think in order to answer that, I need to tell you a story about my friend, Roger Tempest. I met Roger, the custodian of a 3,000-acre estate in Yorkshire, England, known as Broughton Hall, about 6 years ago. And Roger is an interesting character. He looks a little disheveled. He's quite artistic, very quiet when you meet him. He doesn't look like the 32nd heir to the Tempest family estate, which can date itself back to the time of William the Conqueror. And when I first stayed with Roger at his 16th century manor house in northern England, I was amazed not only at this estate and this home and the architecture and the paintings and the history, But I was also amazed at the historical gardens that surrounded the place, the statues, the beautifully manicured lawns, the pristine ponds, the fountains and the walkways. It was everything that you think of when you think of Mr. Darcy, right? It was this pristine place of beauty. However, his estate had suffered under centuries of domestication, of cutting down trees, of sheep grazing, and it had turned Broughton into an idyllic country manor house for sure. But it lacked biodiversity, and it lacked the once wildness that makes God's own country what it is today. So over beers at his local pub, I think it was called The Bull, Roger explained his vision to rewild this corner of the world, to renew this once wild landscape, and to return it back to the natural order of things. His mission was to protect and enhance the diversity of wildlife and natural habitats on his estate, and then to reconnect visitors with the natural environment. And in so doing, he aims to demonstrate that humans can live in a more fruitful and positive partnership with the land in a way which helps nature to truly flourish. And so today, the Broughton Sanctuary Nature Recovery Program is a heartfelt commitment to address one of our deepest contemporary crises, our lack of harmonious coexistence with the earth. And to do so, Roger and his team, as the stewards of this incredible estate, are planting 250,000 trees. They are reducing sheep grazing. They are reintroducing beaver to create natural dams and ponds. And they are increasing biodiversity throughout the entire estate. In Roger's words, "We recognize that to obtain peace within our outer nature, we must also obtain peace with our inner nature. The change we need to see will not only come through rewilding the land, but also through rewilding the spirit. It is our desperate search for more, bigger, and greater that we have forgotten that we are not separate, but in fact, we are part of an interconnected web of life. Rewilding the spirit is about remembering that we all belong to the same web." And when I heard him say that, I immediately knew what he was talking about to an extent, but I also immediately knew that he was right. We need not only an outer rewilding, but an inner one. We also need spiritual diversity and a liberation from domesticated theology. So rewilding is an environmental term, meaning letting nature to take care of itself and referring to conservation strategies that reintroduce species to their natural environment to restore wilderness areas and the land to its original state and to create corridors to connect lands and species with each other. But rewilding also resonates deep down, personally, spiritually, even maybe professionally, and it brings to mind a desire to be a young child again, walking in the woods, full of wonder, running free in the forest. It evokes images of a return to Eden, where flora and fauna alike flourished with only minimal cultivation. And it reminds us that too much control and too much domestication and too many constraints on our bodies, on our hearts, on our souls, on our spirituality leaves us domesticated, and it causes us to lose part of our essential nature. And the same, of course, is true for our souls. When faith only serves to box us in, to tame us, to control us, to give us answers, we lose part of ourselves. We lose touch with everything wild around us, and I think we even lose touch with God. So, we have a chance to rewild our understanding of spirituality by freeing God from the institutional house we built to contain her. We have the opportunity to trade in certainty for wonder and literalism for mystery. We are invited to rejoin the wild, unorthodox way of Christ that wandered through the wilderness. We can rebuild our sacred relationship with the natural world. We can abandon our desire to dominate culture instead of transform culture. And as stewards of this once wild faith that has all but been domesticated, we have a duty to free our faith from some of the repressive, world-denying, and destructive practices that have facilitated our spiritual stagnation. I am reminded of the work of D.H. Lawrence, who in the 1920s wrote, "The adventure has gone out of Christianity. We must start a new venture towards God." And I believe what he was referring to potentially could be claimed as a great spiritual rewilding project. So if rewilding the environment starts with restoring the world to its Eden-like state, how do we rewild our faith in the same way? Well, I think it starts with returning to the land and to returning the land to its natural state. And rewilding the soul really means the same end. It is a return to our original essence as human beings. And that original essence is goodness. It is not sin. So that's the first step, I think, in a practical rewilding, is to recognize we were born good. We were not born evil. The Genesis narrative told us this in the beginning. We've just lost sight of it. In the beginning, God created, and it was good. And at the end of creating, God looked at all she had made and said, "This is very good." So our origins lie in goodness, in original blessing, not in original sin. To recapture our Edenic state of goodness, I think, is the first step toward rewilding Christianity. The Augustinian belief in original sin has domesticated us far too long, and the damage done to our earth, our bodies, and our souls is plain to see. Because if we think the physical world is inherently bad and will one day be destroyed anyways, well, why waste time stewarding it? If we believe we were born bad instead of just sort of broke that way, there's no limit to our license for depravity. And the accentuation of original sin leads to haunting insecurity, a negation of the body, and a shameful understanding of human sexuality. But thankfully, hidden behind centuries of institutional religion and spiritual control lies the prime essence of who we are. And that is that we were born as image bearers, as holy divine images of God manifested in the natural world. And that also points us to something else, sort of the second way in which we can rewild our faith, and that is to reclaim a creation-centered spirituality. And I think creation-centered spirituality is at the core of what it means to rewild Christianity. So what is this? What does that? What does it mean? Well, creation-centered spirituality begins with God's creative energy, and God's creative energy, first and foremost, in this lens, is feminine. It's nurturing. It's kind. It's compassionate. It's birthing. The God of creation-centered spirituality isn't the divine lawmaker and judge, the asshole in the sky. It is our mother. It is the sustainer, the creator. And this idea is an eternal connection that makes between matter and spirit. So instead of control and judgment, creation spirituality embraces letting go. Another thing about creation-centered spirituality is that salvation isn't just about me. It is cosmic. That the renewal of all things will truly be the renewal of all things. All things will be well, and all nature of things will be well, said the great mystic. Also in creation-centered spirituality, eternal life is now. The kingdom is here. And it starts with the idea that God is here, that God's home is our home, that we aren't actually separated from God after all. Theologian Marcus Borg wrote, "The spiritual journey in Christianity as well as non-Christian forms is about the hatching of the heart, the opening of the self to the reality of the spirit. This opening begins the process by which the self at its deepest level is reoriented and transformed." And I think part of that transformation is the recognition that God is already here. God is not somewhere out there embodied somewhere else, but God is here. And this leads to what theologians have called a panentheistic, which is that actually a word? I think I just made that word up. Anyways, they're referring to panentheism, which is a theology that imagines God not as some supreme ruler to whom we owe all of our allegiance, but instead as a being with whom we are reciprocally connected. And though the word panentheism is only about 200 years old, the notion is actually really, really ancient, and it is connected. It is a bedrock to creation-centered spirituality. Rather than imagining God as a person-like being out there, this concept imagines God as the encompassing spirit in whom everything that is. The universe, therefore, is not separate from God, but in God. And this is the meaning of the Greek roots of the word panentheism. Panentheism, pan means everything, in means in, and theism comes from the Greek word for God. So in its clearest compact expression, panentheism is attributed way back to Paul in the book of Acts, where he says, God is the one in whom we live and move and have our being. Now, this concept doesn't reduce God to the universe or identify God with the universe. God is still more than everything, even as everything is in God. The universe isn't separate from God, and neither are we. And I think this concept suggests that God is as close to us as our breath. And that is truly a rewilding experience. If we could reclaim the idea that we are one with God, that God is right here with us, that the universe is the sacred home of God, well, that would rewild my entire understanding of what it means to be human. I believe that we are living in an age that almost directly mirrors the challenges that Christianity felt in the fourth century when Constantine converted the church to the empire, or when Christianity became the official religion of Rome. And almost overnight, the radical, wild Jesus movement was domesticated. Once a subversive movement of social and political radicals, Christianity became the religion of the rich, the powerful, and the politically motivated. Sound familiar? I mean, it's literally, we're looking at a mirror image of the fourth century today. Christianity in Rome became civil religion. Evangelical Christianity in America is state-run religion. It is the religion of the powers that be. And that was never what Christianity was supposed to be like. Followers of Jesus back then, who had lived peaceful and non-aggressive lives on the margins of society for over 300 years, suddenly found themselves bearing arms for God, storming the seats of power as they moved up from the catacombs to the Senate floor. The persecuted became the persecutors. The cross, once a symbol of shame, became the imperial icon of military conquest. And what happened? Well, following the crazy way of Jesus was reduced to an innocuous believing right things about Jesus. So Christianity was domesticated in the fourth century, and I think it has become even more domesticated and impotent in our century today. So what happened back then? Like, what can we take from this? What can we take from the fact that we are reliving another spiritual domestication of our faith as it moves into the halls of power? Well, back in the fourth century, a group of mystics and monks fled Rome, fled the centers of power when their faith was corrupted, and they moved to the deserts of Palestine, Syria, Egypt, and Arabia in an attempt to recapture that once wild faith that was preached on hilltops and calmed the seas and wandered in the wilderness. The desert mothers and fathers, as they came to be known, rejected domesticated Christianity for a faith that was rooted in personal experience, meditation, spiritual tools and technologies, silence, inclusive community, and mysticism. As Thomas Merton told us, these desert mothers and fathers sought a way to God that was uncharted and freely chosen, not inherited from others who had mapped it out beforehand. In so doing, they carved out the first path of Christian rewilding. According to the author and biologist Rupert Sheldrake, in the Middle Ages, there were all sorts of ways to pursue a Christian path. There were hermits living in caves and contemplative monks spending hours a day in meditation. There was a very strong mystical strand in medieval Christianity, and in the Protestant Reformation, almost all of that was lost. Almost all of that was repressed to textualism, to thinking the right things, to believing the right things, further domesticating our faith. So, what do we do? Well, we've been aware for a long time that institutional Christianity is dying. You can look at the stats. I'm an Episcopalian. Everything says that the Episcopal Church will be dead in the next 100 years. There's just no life there. So, what is going to take the place of the institutional church, the church on the corner? What is it going to look like? Well, we are also in a season of the church and arguably the world where we are trying to reclaim our connection to the earth. We're laboring to decolonize ourselves from our past and return to our grassroots, return to a nonviolent way of being that reveals the goodness of all things. So if we want to increase biodiversity, we also want to increase theological diversity, and we want to figure out what is going to come next once the institutional domestic church dies. I don't know what that's going to look like. I have no idea. So as you consider ways to rewild your faith, as you consider what the church of the future might look like, a church filled with mystics instead of believers, I would encourage you to start small. Start small by going outside, meditating outside, doing walking meditation, walk a labyrinth, take a hike in the fields or in a mountain, plant a garden. Learn about the land upon which you live. Learn about the original inhabitants that were driven off the land so that you can live there today. Create a nature journal. Live with less. Sell your excess possessions. Notice the perennial cycle of birth and growth and decay and death and rebirth and all things. As I record this right now, I am sitting in my basement in Colorado. It's a rather warm day. There's still snow outside, but we are beginning to see the inklings of spring. And it is an invitation to remember that we exist on a living planet, and that living planet is giving us wisdom all the time. And it's telling us this is what your life is actually going to look like. Your life is going to mirror the life of the earth, that there will be a season of birth. There will be a season of growth and maturation. And there will also be a season of decay and death. And guess what? That death will spawn a rebirth, a renewal, a resurrection. So rewilding says that you and I are physically and mentally and emotionally and spiritually amazing, that we are divine image bearers sent into this world to spread God into all things. And I think the answer to our problems is available within us, and that we need to reclaim that image bearingness. So I think this great rewilding project is a return to an experiential Christianity, one of pilgrimage, one of encountering holy places and spaces, and instead of a religious tradition based on intellectual confession, let us choose experience. Let us choose embodiment. Let us choose mystery. And may we choose wonder and curiosity over certitude. So I welcome your comments. I welcome your feedback. I would love to know what rewilding yourself and rewilding your faith might look like to you. I'm sure I missed out on a lot of things. This was just a stream of consciousness kind of conversation that I threw together, but I do welcome your feedback. Yeah. What is rewilding to you? Is it necessary? What will the church look like in the next 200 years? Will it even look like church? So I will end with a Celtic prayer about rewilding, and may it give you peace, renewal, and strength as you move from reconstruction to rewilding. Give me ears to hear your voice speaking through woodchuck and wolverine, crow and coyote, herring and hummingbird. Teach me to listen. Every creature is a divine word. Amen. Hey, thanks for joining me for this episode on Holy Heretics, where you were kind of just stuck with me. We will return next time with a guest, a more interview style, and I look forward to continuing season 4 in what has become, I think, one of our best seasons to date here on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for joining us. This episode was produced by the Sophia Society and written by Gary Allen Taylor. Music is by Faith and Foxholes. If you need more resources to guide your spiritual journey, head to sophiasociety.org for articles, resources, and our free ebook on faith deconstruction. And before we go, will you consider joining us on Patreon? Your partnership allows us to continue creating this sacred space for seekers like you. By becoming a patron, you gain early access to each podcast episode, as well as premium content, and an exclusive invitation to join our monthly online community. Simply sign up at patreon.com/holyheretics. See you next time.